Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And this program is Living with Breast Cancer Treatment Update. And today's focus is part one. This is part one of a three-part series, updates on the treatment of estrogen receptor, or ER-positive, progesterone receptor, TR-positive, and HER2-positive breast cancer. So we have a lot to cover today. And we have wonderful speakers on our call today. I want to just say that this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and many, many other breast cancer organizations as well, all of whom have helped to spread the word about the program. And them, all of those organizations, plus your interest in the program, we have over 687 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, and the United Kingdom, so really a bit of a global call as well. Now, today's program has been supported by a grant from Genentech, Genomic Health, Inc., Novartis Oncology, and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series, this program today, and also for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Julie Grelo. Dr. Grelo is Professor of Medical Oncology, Jill Bennett Endowed Professorship in Breast Cancer, University of Washington School of Medicine. She's also Director of Breast Medical Oncology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Grelo is going to address updates in the treatment of ER, PR, and HER2-positive breast cancer, including stage, grade, and receptors, and the role of diagnostic testing and personalized care. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Grelo.
Thanks, Carolyn, and good morning, everyone on the call. I've heard we have over 600, almost 700 people on the call, so we're thrilled to be here. My role is to do an introduction to what amounts to be a two-part series. Today we'll focus more on the treatment of estrogen receptor positive and HER2-positive breast cancer, and the next update will be on triple-negative breast cancer. But let's talk about where we're going with our treatment strategies in breast cancer. They've really evolved to be more personalized, and that's our goal, is to try to personalize our treatment recommendations both to the patient and to the specific tumor. So with respect to the patient, it's very clear that there are patient factors that need to be taken into account regarding treatment recommendations: the patient's age, the menopausal status, their overall health and other medical conditions, the patient's priorities, where they are in life. That clearly plays a major role. What we're mainly going to talk about today is how we personalize to the actual cancer or the tumor. And traditionally, for the past several decades, the stage of the cancer has played a major role in our recommendations for treatment. But more recently, we've been bringing in the concept of the biology of the cancer, which may trump the actual stage. Let me tell you what I mean by that. So the stage of the cancer is a combination of the size of the tumor within the breast, whether it's spread to the local lymph nodes and how many, and whether it's spread beyond the local lymph nodes, for example, to the bone or the liver or the lung. Stage zero breast cancer, which we also call ductal carcinoma in situ or DCIS, we're now having major discussions about whether we should really even be calling that a cancer at all, and we're not going to be addressing the treatment of that today. Stages one and two breast cancer, and that's based on the size of the cancer and whether it's in the local lymph nodes, we call that early stage breast cancer. Stage 3 breast cancer, where it might be bigger in the breast or involve more lymph nodes, we call that locally advanced. And the goal of the treatment of stage 1, 2, and 3 breast cancer is clearly cure. stage 4 breast cancer we call metastatic or advanced, and that's disease that's clearly treatable, and our primary goal is prolongation of life, improvement and preservation of quality of life. Now let's talk about biology. I'm telling you that increasingly this is directing our therapy, somewhat independent from stage even. When we look at the biology of the cancer, we look at the grade. That's something the pathologists tell us about the aggressiveness of the cancer. How different does the cancer look from normal breast cancer cells? We look at certain proteins and genes, including estrogen and progesterone receptor, two hormonal receptors, and HER2, the human epidermal growth factor receptor. We might get information about the tumor's proliferation rate, how fast is it dividing, or something called, you know, the mitotic rate or index, which is how many of the cells are actively in the middle of cell division at a given time. With all of our increasing knowledge about the human genome, we had a project called the Cancer Genome Atlas Project, in which for breast cancer, we identified 4 major subsets looking at a bunch of different genes and how they're expressed. So we have 4 different subsets of breast cancer, and then we even have subsets of some sets. But I'm throwing out a few terms just because some of you may have heard them, and in the future, you'll probably hear them more. The first subset is called luminal A, and that's generally estrogen receptor positive breast cancer that's kind of got a low grade. It's a quieter cancer. It's a good actor. It's usually going to be very sensitive to anti-estrogen treatments and probably not have much benefit from chemotherapy. The luminal B subset is also generally estrogen or progesterone receptor positive, but it's a more aggressive subset. And it could even have HER2 expression in that subset. And that's going to be a group that might not have as much benefit from endocrine therapy, although usually at least some, and might have some added benefit from chemo. We have a subset called the HER2-enriched subset, and that's a group that all express HER2, but generally don't express estrogen receptor. They're going to be very sensitive to HER2-targeted therapies. And the fourth subset is called the basal subset. That's a totally different set of genes that are turned on. We equate it to what we call triple-negative breast cancer, although it's not 100% correlated with the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 receptor being negative. That's the triple-negative breast cancer. So that's the biology of the cancer, and when we look hard enough, we see that all cancers are actually different if you look hard enough. Now, we're doing more and more diagnostic testing that includes looking at the DNA level, the RNA level, the protein level. If you remember back to your biology in high school, DNA is our genetic code, and we keep that code in all the cells of our body. And then through RNA, we translate the DNA into proteins, which are the working pieces of our body. And so RNA is the middleman. So when we talk about doing gene expression profiling, we're talking not about do the genes exist, but how are they being converted into proteins? Are they ramped up? In a given cell, are certain genes being expressed by converting from DNA through RNA to protein? So that's a little bit more biology than a lot of patients need to know. And then it's the proteins, such as estrogen receptor, such as HER2, that are very important in making a lot of treatment decisions. For early stage breast cancer, we have several gene expression assays that are sometimes being added on to the standard workup in order to make decisions about risk of recurrence as well as response to endocrine therapy, who should get chemotherapy with early stage disease, and which tumors really are likely not to benefit from chemotherapy. Some of those assays, and I'm not here to sell any of them, but would include Oncotype DX or MammaPrint or the Breast Cancer Index. And there are several out there that for patients with early stage disease, we would use in order to make decisions about who should get chemo, who should just get endocrine therapy, et cetera. In advanced stage or metastatic breast cancer, we're increasingly doing genomic profiling. where we're taking the tumor and we're doing sequencing of the DNA. We're looking for mutations in certain genes, and we're looking at which genes are being expressed and which aren't. And we're then hopefully going through the process of doing trials that say, okay, based on this information from genomic profiling, which drugs are likely to work? And now we're starting to look at a bunch of other targeted agents beyond agents that target estrogen receptor and HER2. We have a big national trial called the National Cancer Institute MATCH trial, where we're taking tumors that from patients with metastatic or advanced cancer, any kind of solid tumor and lymphomas, and we're doing genomic profiling and then looking to match targeted therapies based on the genomic profiling. That's something that might be an option for some of the patients who are on this call. Just recently, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ASCO, has started their own smaller version, which they hope to ramp up, of a similar trial they're calling the TAPUR trial, T-A-P-U-R, where they're also doing genomic profiling in metastatic and advanced cancers and then matching to about 17 different drugs, none of which are really approved in breast cancer, but seeing if doing this genomic profiling and then matching to targeted therapies does better than standard therapy. So we're in a totally new era. We're in our genomic era now, and we're very excited about the personalization of our treatment recommendations to both the patient and the tumor. And now you're going to hear more about how we're doing that real time from my colleagues who are going to follow me on the call. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grelo. That was really exquisite, really a fantastic overview to the program today and all this wonderful information. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Jen Rosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Medical Director, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, Division Head, Hematology and Medical Oncology, the Cooper Health System, Professor of Medicine, and Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Grana is going to present on treatment of ER-positive breast cancer, treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer, and investigational new drugs in clinical trials. It's really now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Grana.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a lofty goal to cover all of this in 9 minutes, so I'm going to give you an overview of what's currently in practice and then move and talk about what's in clinical trials. So let's begin with early-stage breast cancer. We said that once surgery has been completed, the job of the oncologist in collaboration with the patient is to determine the future behavior of that particular cancer or prognosis, and then to select the appropriate treatment options for that patient. And they may vary from patient to patient. That may include chemotherapy, hormone therapy, a combination of both, or HER2-new targeted therapy if we have a cancer that's HER2-new enriched. In early-stage breast cancer, the goal is cure. The goal is to decrease risk of recurrence and improve survival. And again, a lot of decision-making goes into this that includes patient factors and the tumor factors that Dr. Grelo spoke about. Let's focus first on early-stage estrogen-responsive disease or estrogen receptor-positive disease. This is a situation where hormones alone may be used, or hormones following chemotherapy can be utilized. And again, we use tools such as Oncotype or MammaPrint or others to help us make a decision of whether chemotherapy is appropriate for these patients with early stage breast cancer or whether hormone therapy alone is the right approach. The choice of hormonal therapy very much depends on the menopausal status of the patient, and that gets at the source of hormones in a woman, of estrogen production. In a premenopausal woman, the ovary is the overriding producer of estrogen, and for those women, tamoxifen is the main agent. It's an estrogen receptor blocking agent or a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And we have very good data that it's an effective compound when used for 5 years, and now 2 European trials suggest that 10 years of therapy may be better than 5 with some additional risks. So clearly tamoxifen is the agent for premenopausal women. Now, depending on the woman and her risk factors, we may consider ovarian suppression, be it surgical or medical, along with tamoxifen, or ovarian suppression, plus an aromatase inhibitor. A large trial called the SOFT trial presented data that for young patients, earlier, younger than 35, or for older patients who continued to menstruate after chemotherapy and were high risk enough to receive chemotherapy, that the ovarian suppression arm with aromatase inhibitor may be superior. So again, this is a conversation that is had between the oncologist and the patient, but again, tamoxifen or this concept of ovarian suppression. For postmenopausal women, aromatase inhibitors have really become the mainstay of therapy, and there are probably three very viable options that include either 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor, 2.5 years of tamoxifen plus 2.5 years of an aromatase inhibitor, or 5 years of tamoxifen plus 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. A lot of variability amongst those choices, but by and large, we don't know that any one of those is superior to another, so these are all options that will be presented to women. There's an ongoing study looking at 10 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy. We don't have results on that as of yet. And then I think the research is moving us in the direction of looking at combinations of biologic compounds with hormones. So, for example, a large ongoing study looking at Afinitor plus hormonal therapy. Afinitor also goes by the name of everolimus. Or another drug looking at palbociclib, Ibrance, given with a hormone. These two drugs are being looked at as agents that will enhance hormone effectiveness, and we're moving them into the early stage setting from lessons learned from advanced disease. I'm going to leave my colleague next to talk about the side effects of these hormonal agents and the management of them, but these are not without their own issues, and a lot of time is spent in the oncologist's office talking about management of toxicity. Early stage HER2-new positive disease. We think of patients that are 5-6 millimeters or larger, even those that are node negative, that should be considered or evaluated for HER2-new targeted therapy. Some patients may be considered and may not be felt to be appropriate, but at least the thought needs to be given. And again, the concept with the HER2-new targeted therapy is to target the HER2-new receptor and to change the biology of those cancers that tend to be particularly aggressive. Several regimens exist for early stage breast cancer. Some of you have heard about Taxol given weekly for 12 weeks with Herceptin, Adriamycin and Cytoxan followed by Taxol and Herceptin, Taxotere, Carboplatinum and Herceptin. All of these are options for the woman with early stage breast cancer, and the choice will depend on the patient, her cardiac status, and other comorbidities. The key is that Herceptin should be completed with a one-year course of therapy. Careful monitoring of cardiac function is imperative. Now, there's another drug that's on the market, pertuzumab or Perjeta, that has been tested in the preoperative setting. These are women who had not yet gone to surgery. In that setting, it was shown to be very effective. It was tested in tumors that were larger than 2 centimeters or lymph node positive, and the FDA approved it in the preoperative setting. NCCN guidelines, those guidelines that many oncologists will refer to, however, also include that agent in the adjuvant setting, so it is a discussion that needs to be had. Where are we going with research in early stage HER2-new positive disease? New drugs that are on the market for metastatic disease, T-DM1 or Kadcyla, is being studied in earlier stage disease. Vaccines are being looked at in earlier stage disease, so there is a lot of activity in this area. Now, moving quickly to metastatic disease, the priorities are quite different. Here, we're looking for response, control of disease, and also a major focus on toxicity because we're looking at this as a long-term project and we want to manage each piece of this well with minimal toxicity. The treatment here is also based on the estrogen and HER2-new status of the cancer. But again, here, the decision-making is a little bit different. It's affected by the extent of disease. Is there a large burden of cancer or small? The severity of the symptoms, and also patient goals. In cancers that are metastatic and estrogen receptor positive, unless there is very significant disease, and I mean disease in the lung or in the liver, we can begin with hormonal therapy, and often patients will remain on hormonal therapy for long periods of time. You choose the hormone that the patient has not been previously exposed to. These include aromatase inhibitors, fulvestrant or Faslodex, and I can't overstate the importance if a woman is premenopausal of making her postmenopausal to enhance outcome. Three commonly used combinations are important. So we currently have data that letrozole and palbociclib are is a very good strategy with prolonged benefit. Faslodex plus palbociclib is another option. And exemestane plus Afinitor is another combination. So we're now moving into the area of not just single hormonal agents, but combinations of hormones and biologics to enhance the activity of the hormonal therapy. Patients are monitored for response, and we continue hormonal therapy until there's progression. And if there's progression, we can move on oftentimes to other hormones, or if the situation should warrant, to chemotherapy, where we have many options in the chemotherapy arena. The HER2-positive setting in metastatic disease also has many, many options. You can combine hormonal therapy with Herceptin, hormonal therapy with Ticerb. You can use Perjeta and Herceptin in combination with chemotherapy such as Taxotere. You can use Kadcyla or T-DM1, which is a chemo conjugate. It's a conjugate that entails Herceptin conjugated to a chemotherapeutic compound. You can combine Herceptin and Ticerb, and you can combine Herceptin with a variety of chemotherapy agents. Many patients will have long control of disease and beyond these agents for long periods of time, and often have excellent responses that can be maintained for long periods of time. Some patients will actually be on combinations and then be able to be maintained on Herceptin alone. And there is a lot of research looking at new drugs, hoping to overcome Herceptin resistance, and again, vaccines that may enhance the activity of these compounds. So clearly the future is very exciting. There's been significant impact made in metastatic disease, and the lessons that we've learned from metastatic disease are being moved into the early stage arena. And with that, I'll stop.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grana. That was really outstanding and just so very comprehensive for everyone. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Staff Oncologist, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is going to address managing treatment side effects, key questions to ask your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, for this lovely introduction and the opportunity to talk with all of you. Dr. Grelo talked about personalizing treatment recommendations, and I also would like to personalize my advice about how best to manage quality of life concerns and to communicate with the healthcare professionals that make up your cancer team. Let's talk about where we are going with this idea of personalizing how we cope with cancer treatment side effects and the whole cancer experience. I could recite a lot of common side effects, but I will try to minimize the amount of side effects I discuss in general because every individual has a different way of experiencing these, and some may consider some side effects tolerable or reasonable, and for others, it may be incredibly important. So I think my first advice is to become very well informed, sometimes taking time to think about what cancer treatment fits you best, to use decision aids, to have conversations, to look for well-vetted, expert-vetted information in the web or in other from other sources. Assemble the proper professional team and also a good team of supporters. friends or relatives or caregivers, depending on the intensity of treatment, but somebody to talk to, a go-to person, and perhaps somebody who can also accompany you, if you are the patient, to appointments and take notes and ask more questions. And then to think about the time in treatment, whether it's a short period of time or a long period of time, as being sort of in training. It will require some discipline to get through some of these trainings, and there may be side effects that persist well beyond the time that the formal treatment ends. It's important to prioritize concerns and find a way of discussing those openly with the professionals and the cancer care team. Find a way of bringing your concerns to their attention and to establish a dialogue with your nurse, with your doctor, with a nurse practitioner, with a social worker, with therapists, and perhaps even with other patients in support groups. So we can talk, just as Dr. Grelo talked about the characteristics of the tumor, we can also talk about the characteristics of the individual patient. How does one cope? How do you cope? How do I cope? What are your strengths? What can we do to shore up your strengths so that the cancer experience becomes more bearable? What makes somebody afraid or anxious? How can we minimize perhaps those periods of anxiety? There are some patients, for instance, who get very anxious between the time that a test is done, such as a scan or a mammogram, and the time that she hears the results. How can we make that better? All this requires very fluid communication, and on the part of the patient, certainly if you're able to prioritize concerns and transmit those to the healthcare professionals, then a plan can be made so that we can address those head on. So before treatment begins, I would advise that you talk with your doctor about possible side effects of each type of treatment you will be receiving. Ask which side effects are most likely to happen, when they are likely to occur, and what can be done to prevent or relieve them. Perhaps also ask about the level of caregiving you may need during treatment and recovery so that you can assemble your families and friends, and they may be able to help you and play an important role. And in addition to physical side effects, there may be emotional and social side effects, and these should be discussed as well, in addition to perhaps thinking about the cost of cancer care. And if that's important, then that should be brought up as well very early on. The treatments for cancer are very different, and each one of the treatments can also induce or lead to side effects. For instance, surgery is still a very important part of cancer treatment, and there may be some postoperative symptoms, such as pain. There may be limitation of movement. These should be discussed because physical therapy can be enormously helpful. Many patients are concerned about the risk of lymphedema, which is swelling in the arm that was affected. This is typically more important for women who have more extensive surgeries, including removal of many nodes in the armpit or axilla, and then receive radiation. There is emerging science about how to treat and prevent lymphedema. We know more about treatment than prevention, but that said, it's very important to discuss this also with members of the team. There have been some very interesting recent research studies on this, and we have some good ideas for how to follow women. Fortunately, these days, the risk of lymphedema that is really serious has diminished as our treatments have become more conservative and we are removing fewer nodes. The side effects of chemotherapy are plenty and many, and they depend very much on the agents that are used. But in general, many patients experience a very unpleasant form of fatigue that we've come to call cancer-related fatigue, and this also applies to patients receiving treatment such as radiation. And this can be a real problem. There can also be problems sleeping. In terms of non-pharmacologic treatments for cancer-related fatigue and for general wellness, my personal recommendation is to stay as physically active as possible. There is some good rigorous science about the benefits of exercise, even exercise during active treatments such as radiation and chemotherapy, and it definitely reduces fatigue and helps patients to sleep better, feel better, move better, and have more of a sense of control. I'm happy to discuss in the question period some specific symptoms, but again, if we start to recite them, this conversation may go on for hours. With respect to the anti-HER2 treatments, one of our main concerns is to keep patients safe. And the cardiac monitoring that was previously discussed is something that is worth repeating. So for patients who are receiving drugs like trastuzumab or Herceptin, we typically monitor their cardiac function for the first year with echoes every 3 to 4 months. It's harder to know what to do for patients who are on these medications for many, many years in the metastatic setting. Endocrine therapy, as was mentioned earlier, aims to lower the amount of available estrogen. For younger women, tamoxifen is typically the drug of choice, and for older women or women who are postmenopausal, we typically use drugs such as the aromatase inhibitors, and these work by reducing the amount of estrogen that is produced in the body even when the ovaries are shut down. The body, in its wisdom, knows how to make some amount of estrogen by other mechanisms in other organs. The most common side effects really are the musculoskeletal side effects, and these include typically stiffness that is worse in the morning or on getting up from a comfortable chair, stiffness and just generally feeling those bones. I have many patients who tell me that they went to sleep feeling they were 60 and they woke up feeling they were 90. For these kinds of symptoms, I think that the best advice is to just know them, understand them, and have a plan for dealing with them, such as, you know, perhaps taking a hot shower, moving, sometimes a mild anti-inflammatory may help, but that's not something that I would recommend on a regular basis. Here to exercise and just having a way of stretching and getting those joints and muscles to move is perhaps the best advice I can give you. Other unpleasant side effects of endocrine therapy are vaginal dryness and sexual dysfunction. And these have been very well documented and studied. And I want to point out that in the studies that were done using the aromatase inhibitors in the adjuvant setting, and that is to prevent cancer from returning, the studies typically allowed women to use some form of vaginal estrogen supplementation. So that is perfectly fine to do, of course, with the supervision of your physician and your oncologist. There are other reasons for women who are on these drugs to have sexual dysfunction, and sometimes it's important to consult with somebody so that there can be a plan, there can be some information, and perhaps the problem can be corrected. Other unpleasant side effects of aromatase inhibitors include hair thinning and hot flashes, and these, unfortunately, are things that each individual sort of learns to deal with. And as I tell my patients, they are perhaps upsetting or unpleasant, but they are not really dangerous. How long to stay on these medications is still a matter of inquiry, and we hope to hear at least from results from one important study in the next couple of weeks at the meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. So in terms of quality of life concerns, to wrap it up, I think that we always worry about diminished function, diminished ability to work, loss of income or self-esteem as a result of many of the physical and emotional changes. We worry about a diminished ability to enjoy life, and sometimes as a result of the cancer or cancer treatment, a woman may find that she has some form of anxiety or depression or mild PTSD, and this requires that a diagnosis and also referral for help. There can be many worries, and worries about cancer recurrence. This is pretty common, and these two can be immensely helped by being part of a support group, of getting some form of individual counseling or therapy. And then, of course, there are all the physical side effects, and they require a personalized plan. So my final words and my advice is to take all of this very seriously and try to be as precise in your reporting as you can if you have any of these symptoms, and look for the help, the professional and expert help that can help minimize the discomfort, the unpleasantness, and the anxiety that these treatments produce so that you may be able to get past them and find a way of improving quality of life and hopefully transitioning back to feeling really well. Thank you very much, and I'll turn this over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Shapira. That was really excellent and wonderful, and also the way you presented this topic is really, I think, very helpful to people, and I'm sure during the Q&A people may have their own specific issues, but I think you put it in a context that is so helpful to people to understand about the importance of their quality of life and working with their healthcare team. So thank you very much for doing that. And our next speaker is Ms. Stacey Lewis. Ms. Lewis is an oncology social worker, and she is the Women's Cancers Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Lewis is going to be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups, so really a continuation of some of what Dr. Shapira alluded to earlier. So it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'm very happy to be part of this important program today. And we just heard the doctor speaking about personalizing medical care. I think that's really a great segue into speaking about how important it is to also personalize your emotional supports and your support system. So I am the Women's Cancers Program Coordinator here at Cancer Care, and I work with many individuals diagnosed with breast cancer, as well as their loved ones and family members. And as I said, we've been talking about managing care and quality of life. I'd really like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network as part of your care and how Cancer Care can be part of that support network. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs here include individual counseling, which we offer face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally, support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York, as well as over the telephone nationally, and online support groups nationally and internationally. We also offer educational programs, practical help, assistance navigating the healthcare system, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and again, all of our services are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person as well as his or her family and friends. We are also trained to help cancer patients and their support system tackle the many problems that can accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustments, and, of course, the psychological impact. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with your diagnosis in all of the areas I just mentioned are also a very important part of your healing process. As you may know, cancer affects not just the person, but the whole person and their entire family. I want to point out that asking for help, whether you are a patient, caregiver, friend, or loved one, is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group can be a way for you to connect with others who are going through a similar situation and possibly experiencing similar problems. Individual counseling can provide a space that is just yours to voice any concerns you have and navigate any of the issues I mentioned previously. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer and their support systems frequently experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with your diagnosis and treatment. I did also want to point out that at this time, Cancer Care is about to start up our summer online support group session for breast cancer, and we have many sections of our online breast cancer support groups, including dedicated groups for metastatic breast cancer and triple negative breast cancer. As I said, we also have general caregiver support groups and patient support groups available face-to-face in the New York area, as well as on the phone and online. So really, we have many ways for you to connect with us and get support. If you're interested in any of our services that I just spoke about, we encourage you to call our Hope Line. That number is 800-813-4673, or visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. Our website is actually very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of information, not just on supports, but also about all of our programs, including information about your diagnosis, treatment, and ways of coping. You can also use our website to register for any future workshops, community events, or those online support groups that I mentioned. We've learned a lot of great information from today's program, and I also want to acknowledge that it is a lot of information to digest. You may have some questions. Our social workers here can help you understand what it means for you, your loved ones. If you have any questions about today's workshop or just want to hear more about our services, I really encourage you to get in contact with us. Again, our Hopeline number is 800-813-4673, and anytime you call, you'll be connected to one of our oncology social workers. So in closing, I just want to, again, acknowledge that no one is alone in this. We are very happy to be here to support you, and I want to thank you for your attention and opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Lewis. That was really outstanding and just a really a wonderful review of the services, the free services that people on the call can access from cancer care. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to explain to you how to queue up for questions. This is a great time to ask those questions that you're kind of wondering about, that you want to get some help with. We want to take as many of your questions as possible. And in a call like this, we often don't get to everyone's question. And if we don't get to your question at the end of the call, I will explain to all of you how to get any questions that left for any of you answered. So hang in there. Okay, so let's see how many we can take now. So Candace.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Stephanie F. Your line is now open.
Yes, this is an excellent seminar. Thank you so much, Carolyn. I have two questions. First of all, I was double negative and HER2 positive 9.5 years ago, and I did have the Adriamycin, Cytoxan, Taxol, and a year of Herceptin. My first question is that for the reoccurrence factor, by having all of this Herceptin and having all these medications, I did the year and 2 months, you need to do more than that? I mean, I haven't had any reoccurrence. And also, is it the double negative that makes it more aggressive, or the HER2, or does it both? Because it wasn't even on, there was no lump, it was in not the mammography, the ultrasound. So I don't trust the mammography, I trust more the breast ultrasound and the MRI. Is that more important than the mammography? Because that was very, very important. Also, have you had studies on Mitake mushroom at all? I was curious about that also.
Well, thank you for those, Stephanie, for all those questions and for your good comments about the call. We appreciate that. Now, I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question in a general way, and I'm going to ask you to, of course, take this back to your treating healthcare team for the specifics for you. So I'm going to ask if Dr. Gronick could start with some of your questions just in terms of some specific areas that she'd addressed.
So fortunately, you're 9 years out, and this is exactly the kind of outcome that we expect with the use of Herceptin. Herceptin has really changed the outcome for women with HER2-new positive disease. Is it the ER negative or the HER2 new positivity that makes these cancers aggressive? It's probably a combination of both, but HER2 new is the protein that we can target to change that outcome, and it was done with you. You were lucky. The drug was approved by the FDA in 2005, so not long prior to your diagnosis. The treatment is for 1 year. There have been studies that have looked at 2 years. It was not superior. That have looked at 6 months. It was not quite as good. So we tend to do Herceptin for 1 year and nothing else. So should you be doing anything else right now to target the HER2 new protein? No. I think you're very fortunate and you've done very well. I can answer the mammography question. I cannot answer the mushroom question. So the mammography question. Mammograms definitely miss some cancers, but by and large, ultrasound should be used as an adjunct to mammography rather than as a replacement of mammography. So I would say that mammography still remains the gold standard for some women because of breast density or strong family history with a hereditary component. We may add MRI, but by and large, ultrasound alone is not an ideal tool.
Okay, thank you so much. And does anyone else want to add anything to that?
This is Julie Krayla. With respect to the question about shiitake mushrooms, I know of no solid evidence, clinical trials suggesting a benefit with respect to reducing breast cancer recurrences or outcomes.
you know, some naturopaths are investigating certain mushroom formulations, but at this point we don't have any, clinical trial evidence for benefit from mushrooms.
Thank you. And our next question on the telephone.
And our next question comes from Joan M. Your line is now open.
Hi there, Joan Maloney. I'm calling from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. I'm a clinical nurse specialist in a breast clinic here. We mainly deal with the surgical side. However, we do hear a lot of women complaining of hot flashes with regard to endocrine therapy, and of course we refer them back to oncology. But just as a general question, given that it is such a common complaint, I hear women saying that they're not all that crazy about taking Effexor. However, I understand that it does really help with the hot flashes. Because of it being an antidepressant, they're concerned with when they come off of it, how's it going to affect their mental health? Is there anyone that can speak to that?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question, and thank you for asking that. I'm sure it's a question that the issue of hot flashes, and I know Dr. Shapiro said that she would address questions as they came up. So, Dr. Shapiro, if you could give some general information about the concept of dealing with hot flashes. It's such a complicated issue.
Sure, happy to do that. So hot flashes are very common in this setting, and I think of it in two different ways. One, are they tolerable or not? There are some women who note them and describe them and live with them, and there are some women who find that it overwhelms their ability to function. So that's sort of the trigger for me to say that we need an intervention, because hot flashes are very common and not every woman will require assistance with them. But if they begin to interfere with mood, with enjoyment, or even with function, then we need to pay attention. And once we go there, then I think that there is a choice also. There are non-pharmacologic interventions. There are studies that have looked at physical activity, vigorous physical activity, yoga, acupuncture. So there are many non-pharmacologic sort of lifestyle interventions, and if your patients are able to try them, then I think that's certainly a reasonable thing to do. And then, of course, there's pharmacology. And in the pharmacological area, there are quite a few drugs that are used, but the two that are most commonly used are venlafaxine, which is Effexor, and gabapentin, which is Neurontin. And these have been studied pretty rigorously, as well as others. So venlafaxine works not because of its antidepressant effect, but because it really seems to have an impact on the neurochemistry in the brain. I also want to point out that in all of the studies of drugs that have been done to treat hot flashes, there's also a very interesting placebo effect. In fact, everything works. So just knowing that you're taking something seems to work. But that said, venlafaxine works better than placebo, and gabapentin for some patients also works very well. There's a very interesting study where patients were crossed over from one to the other, and what was found is that venlafaxine seems to work better or work for more women, but in fact some actually found more relief with gabapentin. So if you need to use a medication and your patient does not want to take a medication that's also an antidepressant, then I suggest that you could try gabapentin.
Thank you. Any other comments? Excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro. And we have a question from one of our online participants from Patricia. And I'm going to ask Dr. Grable if you could address this one. What is the current thinking about cardiovascular effects of aromatase inhibitors over 10 years?
So that's an interesting question. Do the aromatase inhibitors have any increased risk of cardiac events such as a heart attack or things? When we do trials where we have compared tamoxifen to the aromatase inhibitors, we have seen, more cardiac events
in the aromatase inhibitor group. That may very well be due to the fact that some people on aromatase inhibitors have some modification of their lipid profile, their cholesterol profile. Sometimes the total cholesterol can go up. My experience is more frequently it's the ratio of the good cholesterol, HDL, to the bad cholesterol, the LDL, that changes when patients are on aromatase inhibitors. So we have seen a few extra heart attacks, for example, when we head-on compare 5 years of tamoxifen to 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. But interestingly, we also know that tamoxifen in a postmenopausal population can have beneficial effects on the cholesterol. So it may be that tamoxifen is reducing cardiac events. In trials where we've looked at aromatase inhibitors versus a placebo, so prevention trials, for example, where we've been looking at that, we don't necessarily see the same difference. So I think that the jury's out as to whether the aromatase inhibitors have a significant impact on cardiac events when we compare them to nothing. But that does factor into account. I do, for example, follow my patients' cholesterol profile. I know before they go on the aromatase inhibitor, and then I look again after they've been on it a while, see what kind of effect we're having. And of course, any woman with early stage breast cancer we're hoping is cured, and so we are worried about, you know, other health events as they age, and cardiovascular disease is the leading killer, at least in North America, of women. So we're always counseling about ways to reduce your risk of cardiac disease. Interestingly, all those healthy lifestyle things that my colleagues have talked about, you know, physical activity, maintaining a good body weight, eating healthy, they can have an impact on breast cancer occurrence and recurrence, but also on heart disease. So lots of reason to support being heart healthy, which can also be cancer healthy.
And thank you. Anyone else want to add anything here? Okay, excellent. Another question we have from one of our online participants, from Joan. Joan's question is about the interaction between breast cancer medications and other types of medications that a person might be taking in terms of other health problems. I wonder if Dr. Graner, if you could address that.
There's been concern about interactions with some of the supplements, particularly in patients that are on chemotherapy. The major one that I'm aware of is antioxidants, potentially interfering with the activity of Adriamycin. So the data is not very good, but it is an alert that we tend to give to patients. There's been concern about some of the antidepressants, particularly SSRIs and tamoxifen, and the interaction of tamoxifen, potentially altering the metabolism of tamoxifen and interfering with the production of the active metabolite. If you look online, there are a group of drugs. The SSRIs are actually quantified as being mild inhibitors, moderate, or significant inhibitors, and we tend to switch and try to move patients to the drugs that have the least amount of inhibition. So, for example, Paxil is probably not the best of drugs to use with tamoxifen. Effexor may be a better choice that doesn't seem to have the same amount of inhibition. But aside from that, that's one group of drugs. Now, with some of the newer drugs that we're looking at, For example, some of the Afinitors and some of the newer biologic compounds, there are a panoply of foods that may interfere, a grapefruit and certain others. So these drugs actually come with significant guidelines as to what things to avoid and what things to favor.
Thank you. And I think this question comes up on every call that we do on breast cancer in terms of a diet, a healthy diet. I'm going to ask everyone to weigh in on it, and the person particularly, Ellen, also is asking about soy products as well. So should we start with Dr. Shapira and Dr. Graner and then Dr. Graylow?
So what is a perfect diet or what is the best diet? I don't know of a single breast cancer diet or the best proven diet. My advice is to follow a Mediterranean diet, which seems to be heart healthy and generally healthy. So a diet that is varied, that is mostly derived from products from nature rather than processed foods, with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, with grains, with whole wheat products if possible, with a minimum amount of animal fat, and that uses mostly a good olive oil or something like that for cooking and also for salads and so on. I think that kind of a diet is delicious and nutritious. I think the amount one eats matters as well. Every time I think of diet, I also think that related to that is the amount of physical activity we do. So different people have different levels of energy and physical ability, but I think to the extent possible, my advice is to stay as physically active. If walking is difficult, then perhaps water-based exercise. If water is not difficult, then walking, hiking, biking, running, climbing mountains, whatever appeals. But I think that there are enormous benefits to eating basically a good diet that comes mostly from nature, that's varied and accompanied by a healthy dose of physical activity. I think there's some data that tells us that consuming large amounts of alcohol is not good for us. So my rule of thumb is no more than 3 alcoholic beverages per week. So that's sort of the simple advice that I live by and I give to my patients, and I'm very interested in hearing what my colleagues say.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro. And Dr. Brana?
I would absolutely agree with that. I tend to urge people to eat a healthy diet. I think it's very important, particularly in the postmenopausal population, to really try to work on weight reduction. That's the period of time where the ovaries shut down, but adipose tissue continues to produce estrogen. So there's actually data that postmenopausal obesity is a significant factor for breast cancer risk and also for recurrence. So I really try to motivate my patients to eat healthy, really rev up the exercise. There have been trials that show a significant impact of exercise on risk of recurrence. But in terms of more than just healthy weight, healthy exercise, alcohol avoidance, I don't know that I can say that one particular diet or one particular approach is better than another. I urge my patients, if they want to eat soy, to go ahead as long as it's done in moderation. I think soy-containing foods can be healthy, and again, the data on soy is very mixed right now.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Grelow?
Well, I certainly support everything that Dr. Shapiro and Dr. Grant have said. There was a study in breast cancer looking at nutrition called the WIN study, the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, that targeted a low-fat approach, and I agree, who knows if it's fat or nutrients or what, it's common sense to eat healthy. But this particular study targeted women who had undergone breast surgery with either an intervention that aimed to reduce the fat intake, so only 15% of their calories coming from fat, versus a standard group that was followed. And they had instruction and reminders, and they were followed over a 5-year period. And what was seen was that the women who were in the group that had been advised and counseled and supported to reduce their calories from fat, indeed, they didn't meet the goal of only 15% calories from fat, but they had a much lower fat intake from the control group. They had, over 5 years, had lower weight, so they had gained less weight or lost weight. And at the 5-year period, there were less recurrences in the group that had been randomized to have the low-fat diet. No difference seen in overall survival, even looking out now to over 10 years. That did not meet statistical significance, although maybe a slight trend for the diet group doing better, but not statistically sound. So, you know, everybody questioned, was it the calories from fat? Was it less weight gain? Was it more about the weight than the actual fat and the content? But I think it does make the point that paying attention to your diet, to your weight, I agree with adding on the physical activity, minimizing alcohol is important. And I would also support the statement that I believe that soy can be a really good source of protein. When I've given talks in Japan, I've asked, do you advise your patients after a breast cancer diagnosis to change their diet since they have the highest soy intake? And they laugh and say, you know, we don't have a higher recurrence rate. You know, we have a lower incidence of breast cancer. We don't think that dietary soy, at least a Japanese diet kind of dietary soy, has ever been shown to have any impact, and it's a very healthy source of protein.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. And there's a question along that line about sugar. So would you also, Dr. Grail, just comment on the issue of what about, from Cheryl, what about sugar in the diet?
Well, I hear from patients, I read on the web, sugar feeds cancer cells, but it also feeds all of our cells in our body, and we can take fat or protein and store it in our liver as calories, glycogen, and convert it into sugar, essentially. So while I don't think that refined sugars, refined flours, you know, white sugar, white flour, they have no nutritional value. They don't carry vitamins and minerals, and they just carry calories. So, you know, I would think looking, at other food sources would be really important and healthy. But to restrict sugar only but not pay attention to total calories and getting all the vitamins and minerals and not doing other, you know, healthy diet is doesn't make a lot of sense, given that we can convert other sources of food into sugar if our body really needs it. So I don't think we should eat refined sugars and flours, but that doesn't mean that you can't have the kinds of sugars that might be found in fruits, et cetera.
Excellent. And one last late-breaking question from Kate. What is your opinion of using low-dose aspirin, baby aspirin, to prevent breast cancer recurrence because of all the comments about it and other types of with colon cancer and other cancers? So, Dr. Grana, do you want to address that question?
I'm not aware of literature looking at this in breast cancer, and others in the group might be aware of that. I tend to use it again, particularly if I have a patient who's on tamoxifen for maybe decreasing the thrombotic risk a little bit. And I think there's benefit in terms of cardiovascular and other benefits, so I use it mainly for those reasons, but I am not aware of the data on breast cancer risk reduction.
Thank you. Anyone, Dr. Shapiro, Dr. Grelo?
So I've been asked the question by my patients, but I, too, am not aware of any solid data, so I don't feel I can make a recommendation.
No randomized study in breast cancer patients looking at the addition of aspirin or not has been done. There's some data out of the Women's Health Initiative, which just followed what women said they were taking, all kinds of drugs, that suggested that the drugs, that the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, aspirin, whatever, that women who took some doses every week seemed to have a lower incidence of breast as well as colon cancer. But that wasn't randomized. Women who choose to take drugs in that category have other reasons that they're taking them. So I think the data is a bit stronger with respect to colon cancer, with respect to cardiac disease and stroke. But a baby aspirin a day, as long as you don't have any significant bleeding from it, may have other health benefits.
Excellent. Well, I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I also want to thank all of you who have asked questions both on the phone and online. Fantastic questions, actually, that really enable the call, enable us to address some other issues that are of concern to all of you on the call today. And I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning this program, we know that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I just want to kind of sum up. Also, I told you that I would let you know how to get your questions answered if you didn't get to ask your questions. And we do have more questions, so let me tell you what to do. If you have a question that's a medically focused question, I would recommend a medically question in terms of your own, the treatment of your actual breast cancer itself. I would definitely recommend that you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. Their information specialists are always awaiting calls after our programs, and they are very equipped to answer your questions or to help you, to guide you with getting answers to your questions. And, of course, your own healthcare team, of course, is, of course, a major source of you getting your questions answered as well. If, on the other hand, you'd like to speak with one of our oncology social workers about either practical or financial assistance or joining a support group or counseling services, then I would say, or to participate in one of our upcoming workshops or publications, then I would say to call our 800 number, 1-800-813-4673, or you may visit our website at www.cancercare.org for those of you who prefer to pose your question or concern or international participants online. Now, we do have a couple of programs coming up. This is a part one of a three-part series. So part two on May 25th is update on triple-negative breast cancer. And part three on June 1st is precision medicine in breast cancer. And also, I just want to remind all of you that we do have a post-ASCO series, and the first one is on June 9th with Dr. Grelo speaking about breast cancer. So just to stay tuned for that program as well. You'll be getting information about all of these programs, but I just wanted to let you know this. And most importantly, as we're about to conclude, I don't want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with breast cancer and coping with cancer in general. You're now part of a cancer care community, and we're simply a phone call away or a mouse click away. Do contact us. We are here to help you. Again, I want to thank you all for being on the call today, and I want to wish you a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.